that in places like Washington, Annapolis, you're seeing maybe 4 millimeters of sea level rise per year under current conditions. But there's not really anything we can actually do about that. We can't. We can actually stop pumping groundwater and stop the city sinking. With the situation you're describing to do with the ice sheets, then we have to just live with that and we have to adapt to it. We either have to build defences or we have to move or whatever the selected response is.
Radio EcoShock will be right back with more from Dr. Robert Nichols, the director of the UK Tyndall Centre for Climate Change Research.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
You are listening to Professor Robert Nichols on Radio EcoShock. He knows where and why the ocean is threatening land that is home to millions of people. Your new paper is a global analysis of substance, relative sea level change, and coastal flood exposure. That was published March 8, 2021 in the prestigious journal Nature Climate Change. Yes, we can show sinking cities in many countries, but really, Robert, when you add up these local impacts, does it matter on a global scale?
Well, I think the whole point of the paper is yes, because we're saying the average person in the coast is seeing 3 or 4 times the rate of relative sea level rise, so that the substance effects are significant. They are happening in specific places, and there are certainly hot spots there, but it's happening quite widely, and many cities are affected, many deltas are affected, and many people are affected. So I think it brings out, it's often considered just a local problem. I would think it's really a global problem. Back to why we care about sea level. Why should people who are not at the coast care about sea level rise, as you posed at the beginning? Well, for the same reason, we should care about these cities that are sinking. And it's probably in everybody's interests to deal with these problems. We have the Sendai Agreement to do with natural hazards, which is trying to mitigate sort of disaster risk. And this is one cause of disaster risk. People like the World Bank and others who fund development in these areas, they're often saying we should be thinking about our exposure to climate change. I would think they should also be thinking about their exposure to substance and relative sea level rise due to substance as well. And so that gives the kind of some examples, I think, of these bigger picture reasons of why we should be concerned. And also, leaving cities to their own devices doesn't help to find the best solutions. If we recognize it as a shared problem, we can start talking about it, we can learn from each other, share experience, and probably come up with better solutions together.
I noticed that Portsmouth, for example, in the UK, has had higher seas but actually lower flooding events because they've come up with portable water gates and other solutions. And I'm reminded, too, of how heat deaths in some cities have gone down, even though there are more heat waves, because they've instituted cooling centers and so on. And my point is that adaptation may actually cover up some of the impacts of climate change for a while, until the problems become too large for what we can afford to do anything about or what we can really do anything about.
I wouldn't say, I found that way you presented it maybe a little bit kind of negative, in the sense I think adaptation's not about a permanent solution. I think adaptation I made the point that sea levels will continue to rise, so it's a long-term challenge. I think that with adaptation measures, we are always making a decision about how to deal with a problem for a 50 or 100-year sort of time frame or whatever. Maybe it's shorter than that. But then we bequeath the problem. I mean, coastal hazards exist today. Coastal hazards have existed in the past. Then it's for future generations to sort of to think about how they might solve the future problems. But I take your point. I mean, it's worthwhile thinking about the long-term consequences of these problems, but I don't think about covering up. I think we need to manage them for a time frame, but I don't think we can ever find permanent solutions to these problems. I think we are managing them for a time period, and you might think about we're on a sort of pathway, we're on a journey, and what's the best journey that we should take would be kind of the question I would pose. And that's maybe a question that coastal societies should be thinking about.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith. Get all our previous programs at our website, ecoshock.org. You know, Robert, wealthy cities like New York or London can build floodgates and tide gates to stop the highest surges. But although I noticed New York has not done so, even though Hurricane Sandy flooded lower Manhattan, have you collected a sort of list of cities who are adapting well and those who are less so?
Well, I mean, I think the cities, like, the hotspots for good adaptation really are, you say, London. Well, it depends what you mean by good adaptation. So certainly in Europe, London, Amsterdam, Rotterdam, Hamburg, I mean, cities around the southern North Sea, which have had a long history of flooding, and actually in the 20th century, significant floods and deaths, not necessarily in the Netherlands, actually, but in Amsterdam and Rotterdam, but nearby, they are really taking this issue very seriously and planning for it. That experience is spreading more widely now, so I think there's a much greater awareness of it. A city like Singapore, I think, now is also preparing for these issues, and I think many of the cities in China and Japan are also thinking about it. But clearly, many cities around the world at the present time are still thinking fairly short term. I think to think about sea level rise, you're often thinking 50 years, 100 years into the future in your planning to really be ready for these changes.
You mentioned China, and, you know, they've actually expanded land into the sea. They've filled in an amazing amount. You can see it from satellite. And so I wonder how they're going to fare as the shoreline inevitably moves inland into China.
There's a huge... Asia is an area where there's been a huge amount of land claim over the last 30 years. To be honest with you, every coastal city in the world, including in the United States and Canada, has advanced into the sea, even if it's just the dock areas. I mean, around New York, for example, I've seen maps produced by people at Columbia University that show how New York has advanced out and areas that were marshes have been filled in, etc. And that's happens pretty much in every single city around the world because land becomes expensive in cities, so you tend to take it. In Asia, they're doing it a lot now. I think by building that land, obviously that new land is vulnerable to sea level rise. And so I think that the lesson that's learned is that you need to be anticipating sea level rise if you're going to continue doing that. And so, for example, I know in Singapore, so not China, in Singapore, if they claimed new land in future, they would actually do it to a higher level than they did in the past. So they're factoring in sea level rise into their plans already, and I think they would build that land about a meter higher. So they're, again, it's not a permanent solution, but they're buying a good bit of time to make when that land wouldn't really be flooded. Sea level rise doesn't make this policy... It doesn't mean you stop doing this. It should change how you do it, if you do it.
All right. For our American listeners, where are some of the hot spots for coastal change in the United States?
Well, I mean, I think the Louisiana is really the place where the Mississippi Delta, really, I suppose, you know, but it's also the state of Louisiana. You have basically in New Orleans, sea levels are rising at about 6 millimeters. The city is sinking at 6 millimeters. Per year, and in fact, the whole Delta Plain is sinking at that kind of amount. So that's sort of double what the sea is rising, the rate at which the sea is rising. So it's about 9 millimeters, or maybe almost between friends, a centimeter per year of rise. And there's a huge area of land being lost. People say a football pitch is lost every 15 minutes in Louisiana. I'm not sure that's true anymore, but certainly that's a figure I remember in the past. I'm not up to date with the current rates of loss. But there's very large changes going on there. Another region, I think, which is also a hot spot, but less so, is the Mid-Atlantic. We talked earlier how the land is sinking in some parts of the eastern United States, and particularly between sort of New York and Virginia, it's happening at quite rapid rates. And so you find, for example, around the Chesapeake Bay, that there are quite significant erosion and loss of land going on. So I'd say those are probably the two hotspots. And then Louisiana goes on into Texas. Places like Galveston are also seeing issues around exacerbated sea level rise because the land is sinking.
Well, should we worry that this problem will affect food production in an ever more crowded world?
I think we should be concerned about it. I have been doing work in Bangladesh, and we've been looking at the future of actually agriculture in coastal Bangladesh. If you look at some of the early papers and sea level rise, they show a huge area of Bangladesh going under with a 1 meter rise in sea level. When you work in the real landscape and take into account what's there today, actually there are very large numbers of defences. There's 5,000 kilometres of embankments in Bangladesh, and hundreds of, more than 100 polders exist. You know, as you have in the Netherlands, you have dikes and then you have land behind where the agriculture happens. And when we look at that in our analysis, we find if we did things badly, agriculture could really decline. Equally, if we have scenarios that include likely improvements in plant breeding, things like that, maybe agricultural production could rise. So I don't think it's just about sea level rise. It's also comes back to this issue of adaptation. So I think, in fact, the coastal future is complicated, really. I mean, it's going to depend on multiple things and how they interact. What's the outcome?
Well, maybe it's a King Canute situation. We cannot order the sea to be stable. Do you see yourself now more and more as an advocate for preparation and adaptation?
Well, really, I mean, I think I've come to this issue from the perspective of adaptation, really. My interest was always to understand what are the impacts of sea level rise and what, as a society, can we do about it. And so I think, definitely, I think that we should be around the world planning for climate-induced sea level rise, also these problems of subsidence that we've discussed today. I mean, again, they're not so the importance of those varies from place to place, but where this matters, we should be thinking about that. And if you look at London, for example, they have come up with something called the Thames Estuary 2100 project, and that thinks through, how could London deal with a sea level rise up to 5 meters? Doesn't ask when that will happen. It just says, let's imagine sea level rises. What options are available to us? Now, they didn't really evaluate moving London very much in the analysis, but that's obviously an option on the table, implicit in what you're doing. And they looked at the options to keep London where it is, and this costs £15 million, so quite a lot of money. So what's that, $20 million US or whatever? But it means that policymakers can really understand the choices they face with adaptation. And the decision really is in London. They can protect against 1, 2, 3 meters of sea level rise. The options are there. They seem to be affordable. And that's the basis of planning. Now, in other places, maybe you would think you would want to retreat. But even if you want to retreat, you ought to be thinking about that today and not waiting for the storm that pushes you back. So I would be encouraging proactive planning to really be coming up with approaches that we feel can be sustained over the coming decades and longer so that we can have prosperous, healthy, vibrant societies in our coastal areas.
And from your experience, does it take disaster to get governments going to protect their coasts?
Well, I think you do hit on a good point. I mean, certainly a hurricane or superstorm Sandy or a hurricane Katrina in Louisiana, these events shape how we manage our coasts. And certainly they bring home the fact that there's a problem. That's unfortunate, and I suppose one of my kind of passions really is to try and get people to be more proactive and in a set react really to virtual disasters that we might simulate in a computer rather than real ones. But unfortunately, human beings do seem to react, and the political process does seem to react, still seems to sometimes need real events to actually trigger actions.
All right, we're about to wrap up, but I have to ask you, with your experience, do you think that we are in kind of a lag time for climate action because of the pandemic, because of the economic threats that we face? Have we set it on the back burner? Because that really would worry me, because nothing in these natural processes from the ice melt and the heating has stopped. It's all still going, but we're not.
I think clearly the last year has has been, other issues have been more to the fore. I've worked at home for the last 12 months, which is something I never really expected in a million years. If you told me a little bit before, that's what would have happened. But I think, people are preparing. The COP26 will be happening in Glasgow in the autumn in the UK, and we're making lots of preparations for that. I think it's, as I have said already, I think it's very important that we mitigate climate change to try and reduce sea level down to manageable levels. So I think there's still a lot of urgency there, and I think many people are still pushing on that. And I think it's important to keep on reminding people of these challenges. And I think in the coastal zone, it's dealing with sea level rise and climate change, and also the other problems. So the substance issue we've mentioned as well, we also want to be dealing with that, so that we, as I say, give a coastal zone for the future that people want to live in and can have prosperous and healthy lives.
Our guest has been Professor Robert J. Nichols. You can find links to his new paper in Nature Climate Change and other information and materials, a couple of his YouTube videos, in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Robert, thank you so much for sharing your valuable time with us.
It was a great pleasure. Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. If you live or work in a city, we have news about your future. New research shows climate projections of 2 or 3 degrees C warming are not for you. The trouble is, numbers you hear about warming are the global average, so that includes the oceans covering about 70% of the planet's surface. More than half of all humans live in cities now, and the United Nations projects that will go to over 2/3 by 2050. Because cities only cover about 3% of Earth's surface, they do not show up in global climate models. Now a team led by Dr. Li Zhao zeroes in on what cities can really expect. He is the lead author of the new paper, Global Multi-Model Projections of Local Urban Climates. That was published January 4, 2021 in Nature Climate Change. Li Zhao says, during this century, the average city temperature will rise 4 degrees C, 7 degrees Fahrenheit, higher than the year 1900 temperatures. Depending on geography, some cities will heat less than that, some will heat much more, and all will get even hotter during heat waves. Many cities will heat beyond human endurance. It will be dangerous to be outside for long. City dwellers will depend on air conditioning and the energy required to run all that. That is already true in many cities around the world, but the heat is just getting started. I have a 26-minute interview with Dr. Li Zhao, currently at the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering at the University of Illinois. After graduating from Nanjing University, Li got his doctorate at Yale. He specializes in the physics and engineering of the atmosphere, with a focus on urban environments. We don't have time here for the whole conversation this week, and some of you would find Dr. Zhao's English second language a bit difficult. That is a growing problem now that so much great climate research is coming from Chinese-educated scientists. We can't ignore the kind of genius Dr. Zhao brings, and yet English listeners are not used to working our ears so hard. We expect the voices of professional broadcasters to tell us everything. To get this important information out, I am posting the full interview with Li Zhao in Radio EcoShock's blog posted March 17, 2021 at ecoshock.org. That is free audio that you can either download or just click an arrow to listen right then. You do not need to sign up or give your email or anything like that. There is no advertising. I will summarize our conversation now and play a couple of clips, but it is always best to listen to the source for yourself. Dr. Zhao's team used innovative techniques to capture urban warming from a series of different climate models. Cross-checking with a multi-model approach increases confidence in the results. We know cities get much hotter than their surrounding countrysides. Vegetation can cool the land, up to a point, by providing shade and transpiring water.
That's a process that works like an evaporative cooler. By contrast, the materials used in cities absorb heat, like black asphalt roads and roofs. Vertical structures in cities block air transport that might have taken heat away. Then we add all kinds of heat in air conditioner and vehicle exhaust. Cities are heat engines. You have heard about the urban heat island effect, and I have covered that on Radio EcoShock with guests like Dr. Matt Santamouris, Eunice Lowe, and Jane Baldwin. In 2018, I interviewed Dr. Santamouris in Australia about city heat. He measured temperatures of 158 degrees Fahrenheit, 70 degrees C, on an upper-level car park in Darwin. Some places in cities can burn your skin, they're so hot. Here's Dr. Lei Zhao about why cities will get much hotter.
When we build city, we cut down trees, we convert the bare soil or vegetated surface into man-made built structures. So those kind of conversion from pervious surface into impervious surfaces will reduce evaporative cooling. So city will become hotter. And the second reason is, you know, in cities, you can see we have large fraction of vertical faces, like built structures, and those could reduce the turbulent transport of the sensible heat that removed from the surface. So that's like trapping the heat into the urban layer, into the urban canopy layer. So that cause could lead to another warming effect. And also in the cities, because the materials of the, you know, built structures are different from natural surfaces, right, from the vegetated surfaces. This kind of artificial materials of the buildings, other surfaces in the city, those are a good heat capacitor. So they absorb the heat during the daytime, and then they can release at nighttime. So that's really what we call a release of a stored heat.
So most humans will get much hotter than the 1.5 or 2 or 3 degrees C warming discussed by world scientists and governments. I can't stress this enough. Most humans, most of you, will experience heat well beyond that. At times, Dr. Zhao tells us, cities will reach heat as much as 7 degrees C, that is 12 degrees Fahrenheit, hotter than the surrounding countryside, which is already sizzling. Large-scale climate models simply can't pick that up.
If it's under a high-emission scenario or a business as zero scenario, then the city can be warmed up to 7 degrees Celsius, 7 degrees Celsius in certain like hotspot regions. And so we are talking about like 1 to 7 degree warming in future, and with a lot of areas actually has warming larger than 4 degrees.
Dr. Zhao confirms there is special concern for extra heat in cities during the night. Health studies show far more people die in heat waves when their bodies do not get a chance to cool down at night. Cities in this 21st century will be much hotter at night than previously. That also means more energy use at night, and with our current electric system, even more global warming gases from fossil-based power stations. No, those coal, oil, and gas power plants are not shutting down in the next few years. The hotter it gets, the more energy we use, the more greenhouse gases. Productivity also drops. The Zhao study in Nature Climate Change finds one possible mitigating factor. Humidity goes down in cities during the heat. That is key because the combination of heat and humidity causes human death. The guideline is 35 degrees C wet bulb temperature, a scale that measures when our bodies can no longer cool themselves using sweat. But in our interview, Lei Zhao says the ever-increasing heat in cities will overwhelm the lesser humidity, returning to the danger zone. The amount of new heat will vary from city to city depending on many factors, including geography. For example, their projections show cities in the east and northern parts of China will get significant warming. Multiple models show city in the east and north China will undergo about 4 degrees C of warming average this century. Zhao cites the study Future Temperature in Southwest Asia projected to exceed a threshold for human adaptability, as published in Nature Climate Change in October 2015. Looking at South America, the urban hot zones to watch will be inland cities, but it is everywhere. The authors say, quote, cities in the United States, Middle East, northern Central Asia, northeastern China, and inland South America and Africa are estimated to experience substantial warming of more than 4 degrees C, larger than regional warming, by the end of this century, end quote. Giles says studies of coming heat waves in cities are very alarming, going beyond the safety range, beyond human adaptability. So you're still dealing in averages, though. I mean, would the 4.4 degree C worst-case scenario for urban heat reflect the heat that actually shows up? Could some cities become even hotter during heat waves?
Yeah, exactly. So what we are showing here, we actually are showing a summer monthly mean or decadal monthly mean average. So it's indeed an average case. So it is not the extreme event. So so you can consider this is more showing a norm rather than extreme. So then people can expect that during the heat waves, the cities can be even hotter, can be a lot hotter. Actually, there are indeed studies previously, they show that kind of under this kind of worst case scenario, what's the warming in cities during heat waves. And the results are really devastating, it's really alarming. If you look at those temperature numbers, it's actually far beyond the kind of the safety threshold or far beyond the human adaptivity limit. People use like web up temperature to indicate as, you know, human adaptivity threshold. I think 35 degree in web up temperature, that's kind of a commonly used threshold for human adaptivity. And, you know, those kind of during heat waves, those warming scenarios can be much larger than this threshold.
As Dr. Santamouras told us, there is a lot we can do to alleviate some of the heat in cities. Greening up cities is crucial, with trees and plants of all kinds everywhere. Every other surface should be white to reflect more of the sun's energy back into space. We need to increase urban albedo levels. Of course, more city infrastructure will go underground where it's cooler, and homes with basements will increase with value, I would think. There are things we can do. Electric cars do not have hot exhaust systems, while solar and wind power do not add more greenhouse gases when energy demand goes up in heat waves. As with most diseases, though, the best cure is not to get it in the first place. Humanity needs to scramble into an all-out emergency change to prevent the worst climate outcomes. Either that or get ready to suffer through this century. Maybe we can all move back into caves. Be sure to listen to the Straight Science About City Heat from Dr. Lei Zhao with the full interview at ecoshock.org, posted March 17, 2021. If this show has stressed you out a little, go back to last week's broadcast, Coping with the Climate Crisis, with UK climate psychologist Ro Randall. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and caring about our common future. We'll be right back.